Then, next case is 85569 Adkins versus Union Pacific Railroad et al. Council, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Mr. Henriot, did you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, please, Your Honor. 4 minutes.
Okay. As you well know, at 4 minutes, you'll get the yellow light and a tone, but the clock keeps running. Go ahead.
I may have pleased the court, Joel Henriot, on behalf of the 147 plaintiff appellants. The district court erred in dismissing these claims as untimely under the statute of limitations. First, the common law discovery rule is incorporated in NRS 11194E, and each of these plaintiffs brought their claims within 2 years of discovering that they existed, that they had actionable claims. And alternatively, at very least, the statute of limitations is equitably told. They adequately raised that issue, and importantly, they made a substantive showing. On the statutory construction issue, let me point out that this is a construction question. This is not a case where there's a plain reading on one side and then just an appeal to public policy on the other. The language of the statute is sparse, and so it does require some interpretation. It just says that the 2-year period applies to an action to recover damages for injuries to a person or for the death of a person caused by the wrongful act of another, and that that limitation applies to causes of action that accrue after March 20, 1951. But it doesn't define accrual.
How do you square that with the fact that there are other subsections that do include specific discovery rule language?
Mm-hmm. A number of those have been added to the chapter, to Chapter 11, after this 1951 version, although there were a few provisions within even the 1951 version that had the statutory discovery rule included. But the surplusage canon is not dispositive here because, and even Justice Scalia and Mr. Gardner would point out that it is not dispositive because legislatures often do repeat themselves. They do give emphasis to particular points occasionally out of a belt and suspenders approach or to err on the side of caution. But it's not dispositive. It has to be weighed against the other canons. Here, a very important canon of construction is the prior construction canon. When a statute, especially if it has been amended after the jurisdiction's highest court has interpreted language used in that statute or in related statutes, then this court's prior interpretations go to the statutory construction in this case. And here, that is very important. I mean, we set out and the amicus sets out a long history of the common law discovery rule and its use in interpreting the statutes of limitation. It goes back 45 years, 1978, to Sorensen. We set all of those out, not just to remind the court of the weight of history and the stakes, but also because they are relevant to how the court interprets, how it construes this statute now. Because once the court has interpreted accrual, as it has, once it applies the common law discovery rule to this statute of limitations and others in the same scheme in Chapter 11, that is deemed to apply to this statute as a matter of statutory construction, especially where it's been amended.
To the extent you're relying on Peterson, which was the sexual assault case, they did amend the statute and created a specific statute for sexual assault after that split decision was handed down. And I think that's one of the most significant authorities that you're relying on. And then they added in the except as provided in 11215 to make sure that the reader of 194E got the message. That they fixed the Peterson problem in their estimation. So isn't the legislative history a bit of a wash there?
So I don't think so. Here's why. I think that Peterson shows that it was the common understanding of the court that the common law discovery rule would apply to the statute. The majority thought so. Concurring Justice Rose thought so. Justice Stephan didn't disagree with that.
Right, but he went further and just said it doesn't apply. And well, called on the legislature to do something in this setting, which was sexual assault.
Well, he agreed that it would be problematic to rely on that, not that it didn't apply. I think more important for this court's analysis is actually Sorensen versus Pavlikowski, or Oak Grove Investors versus Bell and Gossett, or Soper versus Means, Bemis versus Estate of Bemis, because in all four of those cases, this court applied the common law discovery doctrine to statutes of limitation that were silent as to the moment of accrual and did not include that express language.
Is there any difference between when a cause of action accrues and for tort, you need an injury? And the discovery rule. It seems to me there is, but the briefs are going back and forth without really distinguishing between the two.
So as we set out, we address it in the opening brief, and then we come back around to it in the reply brief with the citation to Massey versus Litton. You have to have not just a physical injury, it has to be a legal injury. It has to be actionable, which includes knowledge of the elements to meet the claim. In a toxic tort, it's a little bit different.
Yeah, and that strikes me that, but in this case, you're saying the people, the complaint detail in great detail alleges that when the people went into the building in 95, they were getting sick and they saw soot everywhere. I understand that doesn't necessarily deal with all the each individual plaintiff that you have, but it stops short of the theory of the complaint that you need to have the medical doctor's opinion that it was this soot and this caused these injuries for this medical reason. I mean, people were getting sick and they thought the soot in the building had something to do with it.
So a few were, and I think this really is an unfair extrapolation from a few points in the complaint. I think that those are primarily important, because they provide data points for an epidemiological opinion. One of the big differences between a toxic tort and just an ordinary impact tort, right, is the question of general causation. And you have to know that there is some causal link between the exposure that you've had and the disease that you have. Once that cluster, and this is the kind of analysis that epidemiologically can only be seen in the aggregate, and then once you see the cluster, then to draw the timeline, you can go and look at some of these facts. When did people start getting sick? When were their complaints? Here we had a few who were working in the basement where it was really unnerving how dirty it was. That is important to draw the timeline, but it only becomes relevant and actionable when you can link it to some disease that you have because an expert has seen the cluster and has established that general causation component. Really, that is what puts people on inquiry notice in toxic tort cases. If you have mesothelioma, Because if the general causation has been established, you know, if you have that disease, to start wondering when you might have been exposed to asbestos. If you have cancer and you watch a commercial, why, yes, I was at Camp Lejeune and did drink a lot of water, then you are on notice that somebody has drawn that general causation nexus. Here, nobody had knowledge that that had been established until 2 years before this complaint. The facts in the complaint then are anecdotal. And what they do is they are relevant to drawing that timeline. Did we raise it? Yes, we raised equitable tolling. We raised it in the oppositions to the motions to dismiss, albeit not at length, but we did raise the doctrine. We cited to Fausto, and in particular, we also made, especially I would say, we also made a substantive showing that it applies, because the factors under equitable tolling overlap with the showing for the discovery rule.
But is equitable tolling, like some courts elsewhere have used equitable tolling to deal with the toxic tort latency problem, because people don't know that they are sick even though they had an exposure because it hasn't manifested itself. Is that a narrower exception than the discovery rule?
I think, yes, it is narrower. I don't think the showing is narrower. I think that it is, in those cases where it applies just the same. So in this case, if NRS 11194E does incorporate that, the common law discovery rule, then I think the showing is the same as would be necessary for equitable tolling. I think equitable tolling wouldn't apply in every case, but it does in this one. The showing is the same that we made. It reminds me of Western Technologies, Inc. versus All American. It was an offset case. The offset was raised post-judgment. It was denied in the district court because the defendant raised the Contribution Among Joint Tortfeasors Act, and it was a contract case. This court reversed and said an offset is an offset, even though the Contribution Among Joint Tortfeasors Act doesn't apply, the Uniform Joint Obligations Act does. So you've made the same showing. Here, it was reasonable for counsel to have focused as much as they did on the discovery rule per se. I mean, if this court were to reverse course after 45 years, and, you know, respectfully, we think you shouldn't. This statute has been amended 18 times since Sorenson, and the legislature has never expressed any concern with application of the discovery rule. But if you were to do that, in fairness, I think it would be appropriate to notice that this would be a change in the law, at least a change in the bar's understanding. All of those cases.
You're saying if we didn't apply the discovery rule,
right,
it would be a change in the
right.
law?
Right. If you didn't apply that, it would be a change in the law. I think all of those cases from Sorenson through Bemis, as most recently as the unpublished Crab case, demonstrate that it is a very common understanding in the bar that the common law rule is applicable to this statutory provision. And if it's not, it was reasonable to believe it was, and to emphasize the points and authorities as demonstrating that the substantive showing is the same as would be necessary under the equitable tolling doctrine. I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel?
May it please the court, Ray Hartman of Perkins Coie LLP for CalNev Pipeline and the Kinder Morgan defendant speaking on behalf of the respondents. This court has a long history of deference to the legislature on policy choices and faithfulness to the statutes enacted by the legislature. This court has said that its role is to declare what the law is, not to create the law. That is what defendants seek here, for the court to apply the clear and unambiguous statute that governs this dispute and to leave the legislating to the legislature. We completely disagree that, first of all, that the plain language is somehow murky or ambiguous here. There are several provisions in 11190 that include discovery rule language. 4E is not one of them. There is nothing ambiguous about the absence of 4E, and under Nevada law, the court should construe that as an intentional omission and not an accidental omission.
Counsel, wouldn't that allow for the possibility that someone could have blown the statute of limitations and be unable to sue before they even know that they have an injury?
No, I don't think that's the case, Your Honor. As part of the accrual analysis, the claim is not complete until there's an injury. So there's much said in the brief, some alarmist kind of doomsday scenarios where you can't get divorced before you're married. You can't lose your claim before you have one. You cannot lose your claim before you have one.
But isn't causation part of the claim?
Causation is part of the claim, Your Honor, but the idea that
you're sick, but you have no idea that it's actually connected to your workplace.
You're on inquiry notice at that point, Your Honor, to...
Because you're sick?
Because you have an illness. But particularly here, I think we can look at the facts, right? While a plaintiff is entitled to deference on the facts that it pleads in its complaint, it's also somewhat stuck with them. We have a lot of facts laid out in paragraphs 202.
Part of the facts here, at least alleged in the complaint, that when people made inquiry, they were rebuffed by the county and told, no, there's nothing wrong, it's fine, just keep going, you know, keep working. It seems to suggest that none of these conditions were disclosed by the people who actually knew about them.
But that's not the test for what a rational potential plaintiff or an injured party would do with the information that my coworkers are getting sick. There's black soot on my desk, where the First Amendment complaint also alleges that they made these inquiries. At that point, if your employer says, oh, everything's fine, which there's no evidence that that's what took place here, but even so, a plaintiff wouldn't be permitted to just rest and sit until 25 years later when doctors and lawyers come together and investigate the situation. They're on inquiry notice at that point to figure out what happened to them, right? That's the whole point of the statute of limitations.
So I apologize,
sure.
But this was resolved on a motion to dismiss, on a NRCP 12B5 motion to dismiss. We have a long list of plaintiffs in this case. How do we know from the face of the complaint that each of those listed plaintiffs was on inquiry notice more than 2 years before this case was filed?
So I think it's important there, Your Honor, to look at the strategy employed by the plaintiffs here. Through the original complaint, the amended complaint, the opposition to the motion to dismiss, both briefs before this court and today, you're not going to hear, you haven't heard, that a single one of those plaintiffs has a particular date that they became ill.
Because all we're looking at is the face of the complaint.
But that's not the theory. The theory is very clear in the complaint and the briefing. Discovery is not when they got hurt in this case or when they experienced an illness. Discovery is tied not to plaintiff's conditions at all. It's tied to when the plaintiff's lawyers and the doctors did their investigation and came up with the idea that this is where the injury is coming from. So this goes to the question of whether there's any need to do any discovery. The answer is no.
Please. But you would agree that in the case of a latent tort where you have exposure to something that is incredibly injurious, but it doesn't manifest itself for 20 years, that plaintiff isn't required to sue before she knows she has a claim.
That's correct, and I think that's the state of the law today. Yeah. We're not asking...
Whether you call it accrual or by the terms of the statute, or discovery, or you get there on equitable estoppel, right?
Right. It's the last element of the claim. And therefore, that's the element that would trigger the
statute. And so these plaintiffs, we have a group of 50 plaintiffs, and I understand that they wanted to saddle and ride the horse that it was when their lawyer and the doctor got together, and that that applies to all of them. But even if you say that's not so because they had manifest injury and inquiry notice and all the rest of it, we still can't count them out on the face of that complaint as not having claims, can we?
I think we can count them out because the strategy was to not go that route. This is the only horse, to extend your analogy, the only horse they're riding. They've had ample opportunity to present any one plaintiff that for which there's a date of injury that would save that plaintiff, but that's not what they're doing.
In the context of 12b-5, I mean, it's a notice pleading state. I get that the complaint is really long and elaborate, but it strikes me that there could be plaintiffs to whom that's a fair comment. I mean, that they didn't know.
So, Your Honor, I'd also encourage the court to look at the history of this case, which is, on this point, that issue was not raised at the district court level. Again,
what issue? The standard under the rule wasn't raised?
No, that there were individuals, that we should look at the individual plaintiffs to determine whether the individual plaintiffs meet the statute of limitations, because that's not the argument here. I would submit, Your Honor, that this is a new rule that they're trying to get through, which is that the discovery here, the accrual, can be based on the study by the plaintiff's lawyers and the doctors. It's clear in there, the only discovery rule argument they are pinning their arguments to is the study by the lawyers and the doctors. So
counsel, so I'm reading on page 27 of the complaint, the paragraph entitled discovery rule, that says in the middle of it, plaintiffs will show that after reasonably exercising due diligence, plaintiffs and decedents did not learn the nature of the cause of plaintiffs' decedents' cancers and illnesses, or that such cancers or illnesses were chemically related until less than 2 years prior to the filing of plaintiffs' decedents' causes of action herein. Doesn't that do it?
No, it doesn't do it, Your Honor. Especially, Your Honor, if you look at the arguments in the full context of the briefing, that could, if in that process they're saying, look, here are the plaintiffs, and each of them found this out at this time, and therefore they are saved by the discovery rule, that would be one thing.
That's what they alleged right there.
But the arguments are clear that they're pinning that not to any individual's injury or date of illness, but to these studies. And so
they're saying that's when they learned that they were chemically related and the nature of the cause of them.
That's correct. That's the argument. But I think that's similar to Fausto, Your Honor, which I was going to get to anyway with equitable tolling. So in Fausto, of course, the elements of equitable tolling are laid out. And I think this case is analogous. And the Fausto case requires the same result here. So in Fausto, of course, there was a two-week delay, not a two-decade delay, which I think undercuts the diligence argument. But more importantly, there was a reliance on waiting for a rape kit to say whether there was evidence of the assault. And the court correctly said, no, you knew the facts. The facts put you on inquiry notice. So you're on inquiry notice here when you see your coworkers becoming ill, when you see soot on your desk, and when it's widely known so much that there are complaints, even if they're rebuffed, that there's an environmental problem here. That's inquiry notice when you get sick, not before you get sick, but when you get sick. You're on inquiry notice to inquire, to go to a doctor, your own doctor, and figure out.
But this isn't like a bunch of people got into a car accident, right? You have people with different kinds of cancer. Why would you expect that they would necessarily make that connection if people are becoming sick with different sorts of ailments?
Well, I think that the idea that it's coming from the building right, is right in the first amended complaint. It's potentially concerning that it's coming from the building. Right? And those plaintiffs, whether it's one manifestation of a disease or another, those people are, if you get sick, you're on notice that, especially under the environment that I'm working in, coworkers are getting sick, there's these environmental conditions in the building, that's inquiry notice.
But even if we credit your position that you don't have to have the doctor and the lawyer get together and determine exactly what the cause is, but that there is some inquiry notice going on here. The complaint, I can't read it to say that one of these plaintiffs is not someone who went to work 2 years before they filed suit and got sick within 2 years after.
It also doesn't say it is, right?
Right, but either way.
Right, and I think that it's clarified by the briefing. It's very clear in the briefing that they're only riding this one horse again, to extend your analogy. There's no other, they haven't pointed to a single plaintiff who would be saved by the discovery rule other than when the lawyers and doctors got together. And there's also no justification for why lawyers and doctors didn't get together when people started getting sick in 1995, or the inquiry wasn't in 2000 or 2010. I would submit that under the plaintiff's theory that they could have waited till 2030, 2020 or 2040. And here's another thing, Your Honor, your point is
Fausto was decided on 12b-5 and
right,
this case was too, and you ought to hold it to that.
I think Fausto is
Fausto was a single plaintiff case.
That's right. And I think that underscores the problem.
And she knew she had been raped by someone she actually knew.
And
so I don't see how.
Well, this goes back to the inquiry notice, Your Honor. The claim doesn't accrue until you become ill or you're injured in this context, of car accidents aside. So you know that you're sick.
And so as soon as you're sick,
in this
you're on inquiry notice that it was caused by your workplace.
Under the facts pled in this first amended complaint, multiple people getting sick, potentially dozens of people, there's 150 plaintiffs, right? The environmental issues as pled in this complaint, the black soot going to your superiors, that is inquiry notice. And Your Honor, there's...
So we don't need to decide the discovery rule issue in this case, is your position?
So my position is that the discovery rule doesn't apply, but even if it did, they were on inquiry notice long before the 2 years. Even if the court were to apply the discovery rule, which I think...
And even though we don't know when these individual plaintiffs went to work there, you're saying in effect their lawyers conceded the point that they were all more than 2 years prior.
They absolutely conceded the point, and it's in the reply brief. The only argument for saving any of the plaintiffs is the discovery rule through the doctor's and the lawyer's investigation. There's no other argument. Now, of course, they want to go back to the district court and do a discovery there, which was not requested at the district court level, so it was waived. But I think the briefing is clear. This is the only one.
I mean, that would be the effect of a denial of a motion to dismiss, right? I mean, this isn't like a summary judgment motion where you have to move to do additional discovery. If you're defending a motion to dismiss and saying, Judge, you shouldn't dismiss it, the implication is the case would proceed and there would be discovery, right?
No, I think the argument would be, Judge, you shouldn't dismiss this. You should allow us to show you that, do an individualized inquiry and show you that the discovery rule does apply.
If you have to do discovery, the motion to dismiss should be denied.
Denied, right. But that argument wasn't made. That's the point. That argument wasn't made at all there. So now that there's several instances, including equitable tolling, that was not raised at the district court level, and now they want to go back to the district court and have a second bite at those arguments.
I just want to go back because I found the specific place in the complaint. It says, consistently, Clark County workers were told by county supervisors that there were no problems with the building or the property. So how is it reasonable if somebody's being told by their employer, yeah, I know you're sick, well, you've got a bunch of people getting sick, but it's not from the building, why would they be on inquiry notice?
Well, the inquiry
shouldn't
notice,
they be able to trust their employer to tell them?
For an environmental, I would say no. I would say once you get ill, you would be talking to your own doctors as to what could be the causes of your illness. And I think we would look at that for individual plaintiffs as well, right? But and to be clear, the doctors that were that were part of the investigation here were not the treating doctors. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I just wanted to answer that.
No, it's okay. I appreciate that. And I think Justice Pickering has another question. So yeah,
what in your estimation is the difference between equitable estoppel and the discovery rule?
Right. They are different, right? They're obviously related concepts. The requirements for equitable tolling are laid out in Fausto. Obviously I don't believe that they were satisfied here, but they are different concepts. And you can have, and I think this comes up if you look at both Peterson and Fausto, you can have no discovery rule and still have equitable tolling. Right. We're not arguing that there's no concept of equitable tolling. We don't think
so. Do you concede that there's equitable tolling that could theoretically apply on a toxic tort take?
The concept of equitable tolling is available here. On the facts pled in the FA in the First Amended complaint, there's, I don't believe, any way to reach an equitable tolling argument given the lapse of time. And the application of Fausto, it will also lead to that same conclusion, Your Honor. And I think there was an incorrect statement about the holding in Peterson. I don't think Peterson found a discovery rule here. Okay, I think Peterson said that only the two-year statute of limitations applies, but there's no discovery, there's no statute of limitations that applies when you're talking about a minor victim of child sex abuse. Unless the court has any other questions. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Let's add another 2 minutes.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
It is a notice pleading state. At the motion to dismiss stage, we certainly argued that the analysis would need to be individual, and we criticized defendants for improperly extrapolating the anecdotes of a few to the entire group.
Do you have a page cite for that?
I'll see if we can find one. We certainly criticized the extrapolation. I think at very least, right, that connotes that it is an individual issue.
So and after the argument that's is done, if you can get us a cite, that would be great.
And then as to accrual, Fausto, right. In Fausto, the plaintiff knew she had been attacked. She knew who it was. She didn't have the type of evidence that she would have preferred, but she had legally enough evidence to go forward. Here, there was no connection that any of these people had, again, at that general causation level, to draw a link.
Would you agree? Even under the discovery rule, the plaintiff doesn't need to have firm evidence establishing the causation. There just needs to be enough to place them on inquiry notice. Those aren't necessarily the same thing, right?
Not necessarily, right? Because you can develop facts over the course of the litigation. But to have some scientist somewhere establishing a link is necessary in toxic tort cases. The vast majority of these people weren't working in the basement. They weren't the people who were unnerved by this soot that they saw. So what, anybody working anywhere in the building who gets cancer is supposed to sue because they knew that one of their coworkers a decade ago was concerned about soot? That is absurd. When doctors and lawyers get together, that is how every toxic tort case starts. Because what you have to happen again is somebody doing the investigation work from an epidemiological standpoint to draw that nexus. And then you get to individuals as to whether or not they can show specific causation as well. But that's always a necessary spot. And until you have that general causation, you don't have an actionable claim, which means you don't have a legal injury. If you're going to look at the legislature and leave it to them, the court can't disregard the prior construction statute. And since Sorenson, 1190 has been amended 16 times, Oak Grove 14 times, since Peterson 12 times, since Bemis 9 times. The legislature has revisited the statute again and again with the backdrop of that case law. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate the briefing and argument. This case will stand.